Hello. Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. And hi, we have the author of Gifts from the Poor with us today. Hi, Dr. Gilhod, or tell me how to pronounce your name.
Well, thanks, Joyce. I say Gilhod. Anything you say, I will respond to.
Gilhod, yeah, thank you. So, welcome, Dr. Glenn W. Gilhod. We're so delighted to have you with us today.
I'm very happy to be with you, Joyce, and thank you for your invitation.
Thank you. So you've written a really fascinating book. It's a bit of an autobiography in many ways of your adventures with taking medicine to remote parts of the world. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to do that?
Oh, inspiration, I suspect, for each one of us comes from the giving people in our lives, perhaps at your mother's knee. I certainly have had all my life the idea that there are people who have received far less than I had, and it's time to pay back even the interest on that investment. And I'm very, very eager to do that in a spot where there are folk who have far fewer resources, at least as we view them. And perhaps that's the thought that many of us have when we hear about problems in some part of the world, be it Joplin, Missouri, or the Congo, or any spot in between. We might say to ourselves, well, there's nothing there. Those poor people are devastated. They have nothing. Well, there's no place like that on Earth, and surely everyone who lives in such an environment has resources of their own, many of them internal resources, from which we can learn a good number of lessons for those of us who are surrounded by lots of stuff, and perhaps may not have the same resourcefulness, therefore, that these people do. That's why I had insisted that this is not just a two-way street. Actually, the balance of payments is probably in my direction, that everywhere I've gone to take care of the impoverished, we have had far more reward returning to us than we have ever given.
So you have had, I know you've had a classical training in American medicine, and you've practiced in American institutions. Are you currently practicing in a hospital in the U.S. as well?
Yes, I'm professor of surgery here at George Washington University Medical Center. I'm in the office of the dean, but a great deal of my clinical work right now is done abroad. I was the fairly standard academic surgeon and chief of transplantation and endocrine surgery and a whole lot of other things, and spent some time at the National Cancer Institute.
Right.
Those very standard things that I think you could probably understand from talking with most professionals. But I kept asking myself the question, you know, if I don't take care of a problem here, surely sometime minutes later someone else will be found to take care of it. What happens to those folk that have no such resources and redundancy as we have them all around here? And I found that, in fact, there are no societies on Earth that do not have go-to people who are there to handle problems. Some of those problems that I dealt with were somewhat specialized. And yes, indeed, you know, as transplantation or as one of the cancer surgeons or as one dealing with some unusual illnesses such as VHL or the others that I had seen regularly, particularly around the adrenal gland and those referred by an ophthalmologist and others, I said, well, what happens to folks who have ordinary problems for which we don't need any research, but this is the golden age of medicine and surgery where people in Africa, should they need a C-section, 1 in 20 of them do not get it. And if they are a male with a strangulated hernia, 1 in 15 of those ever see healthcare personnel of any kind. What happens to those people? And I went looking, and I found that a number of them had improvised or through ingenuity had to make ways of coping with very, very powerful forces. They certainly couldn't resolve all of their problems, but then neither can we. And that got me to thinking about the first world environment in which I live. Never have we ever been able to do so much to so few with so little satisfaction on the part of those served. Whereas there, I get this return all the time from those who are very grateful, but even more grateful when I don't go there to deliver care or impose it upon them. I go there to learn from them and find out how it is that they've responded to their problems and what resources they have that we can learn from, when in fact we finally realize that which has already become abundantly apparent, that we cannot continue to expand the amount that we take out of the total economy for health care, and we cannot further medicalize social conditions, but we have to learn something about the satisfaction of basic human needs, and that humanitarian approach means they have much to teach us, because they've had a postgraduate course in that which we've never learned, how to deal with bigger problems in larger numbers with fewer resources.
Right. So I saw an interview with another physician who also practices a lot of global medicine, and he said, you know, when I teach my students how to do this in the Congo or something, I realize that I'm teaching them real medicine, not medicine with kits for everything and sterilized instruments for everything, but rather having to make do with sometimes with duct tape and whatever's handy, you know. And so yeah, I'm sure you must have experiences along that line as well.
You identified it spot on there, actually, Joyce, when you said real medicine. The reality is what's most powerful, that all the artificiality that we could put between us and a patient is something that's stripped away from us when we leave power and plumbing behind. And we have to go to address those problems, usually with fingers and eyes and ears and enough heart to hold them all together. And that's what they have there. And therefore, the caring component of that is the first order of business. After that, what can we do? Well, we're not going to do nothing. And therefore, we look around and ask them, what have they done? Those of us who feel like we're impoverished, we don't have the most recent DVD or don't have the latest of color-guided remote sensors that can allow us to do minimally invasive this or that. There, they improvise. And you just mentioned duct tape, which is a large, marvelous surgical instrument. And you don't realize how many resources there are at hand if you have the imagination and ingenuity to convert them to care. And the caring comes first. After that, the way will be found, as, of course, it has been before our arrival. And therefore, I take back those gifts from the poor, those resourcefulnesses, the depth of it all is really a spiritual resource that we have to bring back into a material economy.
So when you go to some of these remote places, like you've mentioned, Kuala Lumpur or whatever, so some places where even the government in charge doesn't go because it's too hard, what kind of go-to people do you find there?
Subcultural giants, I call them. When you talk about an area of the world where you expect some kind of help from the government, remember, we're dealing in failed states. The government's on the receiving end from those people, not the other way around. And so you can't expect care from a non-entity. And the failed state, if you look at the roads, for example, often those are gifts from international aid, you'd immediately say to themselves, wait a minute, there's not 4 kilometers of paved road in the whole of South Sudan. Well, what do you think there would be for health care then? There's not a social security system. There are no taxpayers. There are no organizations, even the fundamental infrastructure of trying to care for people. So what do? Well, they don't relate to the nation state as we know of it, because ours are pretty well developed. Long time before that development, we had to rely upon friends, neighbors, family. That relationship, which still today holds up a whole lot better than do most other synthetic relationships. For example, the people in Joplin, Missouri, are getting swarmed by their neighbors, including those people who have come on over and slept under what stump of a tree is left from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, because they understand what's happened there. And I think that's the common human condition that I would like my students to carry away from these places, to come back and say, we are not observers of, but participants in the human condition. And therefore, let us learn from them. What do they do? What do they do? They don't usually have a checklist of things that are put together that say this technique and then second order is this. It's not like the pre pre-takeoff list that we have where everything is routinized, because most of those things don't exist. So they must relate instead. And those relationships are much more powerful than the material resources that we are surrounded by.
Right. You mentioned C-sections. Why don't we just start with that as an example? So if you have a woman, I mean, most babies in the world get born by hook or by crook because women are engineered for that. But there are many times that women get into difficulty in the middle of a labor and they do need some assistance. Sometimes it's a little bit of assistance, or sometimes, as you say, it's a case that calls for a C-section. So in a situation like that, in one of these remote parts of the world, who's there to help?
Yes, so that is a question that is a first-order question that I ask continuously, because of the procedures that I teach, those that I am most concerned about are what I call safe motherhood. And of the five operations that I generally teach to those folks around me, the first three relate to that, C-section being the first of those, and a DNC for products of incomplete delivery for a miscarriage, and those operations that deal with the catastrophe of ruptured ectopic pregnancy. Those are the three that I would like to have them understand for most women of impregnable age. The ones that I deal with for men typically are incarcerated or strangulated hernias. And there are good data on each of these. With respect to obstructed labor, those women that toil very, very long, given a week's trial of labor, you know that's something that's almost inhumanly possible, that someone could come through that. And those that survive, almost invariably without a living child, but those that survive, as weakened and desperate as they are, have often necrosed their pelvic tissues, and therefore I have a residual problem of if you'll allow me the terms VVF and RVF, that's a vesicovaginal fistula or rectovaginal fistula. In other words, they have a cloaca. They are incontinent. You can smell them from 100 meters. They are like a diaper pail walking toward you, very much like the lepers of modernity. So these are the consequences we seek to avoid, and how do we do that? C-section is a relatively simple operation. It doesn't take a professor of surgery to do it. So as a consequence, I have asked, who, once again, are the go-to people here? Who does one call upon? Now, in some areas of the world, I have the luxury of some midwifery where there are women, typically, who are in that community who have even had some period of training. And usually we identify them as experts by giving them a kit. And that kit consists of clips and ties and some sterilization techniques so that they can deliver an infant with some cleanliness at the very least and sterility at the best. So what we do there is try to identify those midwives and bring them up the notch to be able to do C-sections. Actually, even better than that, I go to who is available when the midwives have not yet been trained. And those are what they call TBAs, the traditional birth attendants. These are typically women who have had children of their own and get to be locally identified. I'm not going to come and choose from among the people who speak a different language, have a different culture, or totally different economics.
Right.
I'm going to have them identify who are their people and then enhance their techniques. You have your program about the powerful patient. I am one who empowers patients and enhances caregivers. So if they identify them for me, then I don't take over. I do what I can to assist them. So I'm trying to work my way out of a job. And
right.
On a consistent basis, I help them.
In lieu of hospital care, I mean, here we send pregnant women to the hospital, but in a situation like that, there is no hospital. And so it starts with a group of other women in the community who know how to, as you say, be birth assistants, be there to calm the mother, help massage her or whatever it takes to help her through the labor period, even under normal circumstances. But then if some additional help is required, hopefully there's a midwife who knows more than just a little bit about how to help a distressed labor.
Absolutely.
And
what we are there to do is to help.
You're providing them with some additional training and potentially supplies also to help with some of the more common complications of labor.
That is correct. And what we do is do a lot of training in the course of our visits and find those people who have been identified by the communities, and then give them all that skill that we might indigenize. What I mean by that is they shouldn't look to me. I'm the professor of surgery, and therefore I'm the one that's going to be doing this. I should say to them, medicine is not the white man off an airplane. It is typically what it is in that community with enhanced skills and techniques. Some of that involves some equipment, and we always bring equipment with which we train people, but we never carry it back. If once we've trained them with it, we certainly want to leave it there along with the indigenized skill. But most of it has to do with information. And given the fact that there's some information already there, some of it injurious. For example, for a period of time in several cultures that I've dealt with in Nigeria and one in the Himalayas, the local traditional birth attendants or the midwives always considered that there was something magic or simple they should do about the umbilical cord. And once having clamped it or cut it, they would put on cattle dung or something else. An almost ideal transmission of tetanus spores at the very least, and tetanus neonatorum was one of my leading causes of death when I first worked in Nigeria over 4 decades ago. So what we try to do is to say, yes, you are doing all the right things, but for why don't we give advice in, and let's give you this following solution, which is a sterilizing solution, so that some of the things that you are using, minus the cattle dung, which you think you should never use, and why don't we give you at the same time these all-purpose gloves, which we brought with us, that are going to be helpful in keeping you from transmitting from one patient to another, just like the pre-Semmelweis days, any communicable diseases that you might have there. So cleanliness first, the technique of minimization of trauma, and simplicity. Every time I go there, I say our job is not to complexify their life, but to simplify ours, and to learn how they do it, and how they do it well, and carry that forward with them, enhancing them for those things that are somewhat more complicated and telling them what to do when and if those occur.
That's great. So, but gloves brings up another issue. They're not likely to have an endless supply of new gloves. What happens if they start reusing those gloves? And then you're back almost to where you started, right?
Not exactly. And in fact, that's a very critical point. There's something that all of my people, once they've been out, understand, and no one here would ever recognize, something called a glove drying tree. Literally and actually, I put those gloves out after having been used, and I have for them, for high-risk cases, a supply of our own sterilized gloves, and I put those in a pack. For almost all other purposes, what I do is literally re-sterilize the gloves. And they go into a special solution, are heated and boiled, and then they're dried on out, and then they're folded back up, and with teaching them sterile technique, they are once again repackaged. So actually, the reused gloves are not different than the originals, and that those techniques don't require either an autoclave or importation or materials and equipment that come from someplace else. They're all indigenous.
That's great. So tell us a little bit about the hernias as well, because you said for men this is one of the more common complications that here would whisk you off to the ER or the emergency room. And there, if there is no emergency room and nobody's doing that kind of abdominal surgery, how do those things get handled and repaired, or do they?
Yes, in fact, your statement and the last part of that is yes, most often they don't. And that was the case I mentioned with a survey headed up by a Norwegian physician who found out in sub-Saharan Africa, a man with incarcerated hernia had a 1 in 15 chance of seeing any healthcare personnel. So my job is to go out
and die, or?
And dies, usually. I've had a couple of those that have not died. And those that have not died have an unusual complication. And I've even taken photographs of them, brought that back here to the first world and shown it to my colorectal professor that's straight down the hall from me. And he did not know what he was looking at because he, of course, has never seen that. A colorectal surgeon who has never seen a scrotal colostomy, a colon that was trapped in the scrotum when the hernia incarcerated and strangulated. And as a consequence, this is a very, very unusual survival. Most of those do not survive. They're in unmarked graves pretty well all through Africa.
Right.
What I do then
well, let me
is find
just back
who
up for a second and make sure everybody's on the same page with it. When we're talking about a strangulated hernia, and correct me if I get this wrong, you're talking about a piece of the intestine that has broken through the wall of the stomach, and it's under the skin, but it's through the muscle part. It's supposed to hold your innards inside, and so it pokes up there and can get pinched so that the bowel is unable to move through that part of the intestine. Is that right?
I would agree with you. In fact, you said, correct me if I'm wrong, I won't correct any part of that. That was accurate. I might change a few of the words. I would say it wasn't
right.
The stomach, but the abdomen. I would say the innards that we're talking about are usually a loop of bowel. It can be.
Okay.
It can be
but,
something
but
like the bladder.
I mean, this is not consistent with life, because obviously the food we eat needs to be able to get through to the other end. And,
exactly
and if
that.
If it's getting hung up there, then this is something that will, in fact, cause a major infection and kill you.
Well, in fact, you have just said the sort of thing that I try to get those folk there to understand and to appreciate. You said it in different words than I have. That's why they sent me to medical school as a linguistics course, to say it a lot fancier. But no, you've talked about the unsurvivability of a bowel obstruction, which, of course, is what this situation would entail. And so, therefore, I tell the practitioners, those are the folk who are there. They are the wound dressers, the clinic attendants, these are the people who are the dispensers out in the bush. I tell them what it is like to have a serious problem and what is one that's easily correctable, and how to tell the difference between the two, and which of those are sent on to the smaller number of those that I've brought up to the next level. And for the first ones of those, I say, someone comes in with a bulge in the groin and they're feeling uncomfortable, and they seem not to have this popping back as it usually does. This is what you do. You have them lie down. You get them in a head or at least an abdomen down, legs up position, so that there's a tendency there. And then you try to manipulate it in such a way that it pushes back in. In medical terms, we call that reducing the hernia. It probably doesn't happen.
If you can get that bit of intestine to pop back inside the abdominal wall, then you can either keep doing that, or one could just take a little stitch in the abdominal wall and repair that, right?
Well, yes, more than a little stitch, but in fact exactly what you said for beginning, and that is reducing the hernia is important, because we want to unobstruct the bowel, not only for the sake of the bowel obstruction, but remember the bowel itself has got a blood supply that would be strangulated, and therefore it would infarct, as they say. That means it just dies and it no longer holds the intestinal contents, and now you do have a problem. So as a consequence, what we do is say, reduce it. Well, now that's simple if it works, and it does, and then we say, that one which has incarcerated, that means got trapped down there, but was reducible, that's the one you identify for our next trip through, where I take the next echelon of those dispensers and make surgeons of them. They don't have to be in medical school. They don't have to have an American College of Surgeons fellowship. They don't need boards. I'm going to take everyone I can who's in a position to help relieve that problem and then indigenize those skills. So I say the next step, suppose that you can't just push that back in when they're in a dependent position like that. How about if you put them in something like warm water that relaxes some of the spasm of the abdominal muscles, making it a little easier to reduce it? That doesn't work. I have here a kit, which I give to the second order tier, and I say, here is a spinal anesthesia kit. It's an injectable anesthetic, and I teach every one of them how to do spinal anesthetics, because it's far more safe than would be an inhalation anesthetic, and it takes another bit of personnel to do that. This can only be done by a single. And what we do is we instill the spinal anesthesia, and that causes immediate paralysis of those muscles down there, making the reduction a little bit easier. Second,
so
tier fails.
It relaxes the muscles.
Exactly.
And now hopefully it'll just pop back in, or with a little assistance, it'll pop back in.
Right. And not the popping necessarily, but gradual reduction to slowly reduce it back in there. Yes, the third order of that is, suppose it doesn't, well, then what we might want to do is to make that little incision you talked about and relieve that obstructing ligament. The inguinal ligament is right there. And if what we can do is get them to release that, it should go back in. they don't necessarily have to fix the hernia, but they have to relieve the obstruction and the strangulation. And then at a later time, we can come back and fix that. And I tell them the fourth order of that, this is the advanced course, takes about five of those sessions over years with me to get to this level. If the bowel is blackened, you just exteriorize the fresh ends of it, and we'll come back and put it back together later, because that's a survivable thing, whereas it cannot survive with this dead gut in their scrotum. So as a consequence, having gone through all of those steps, we still have a patient who's alive, even if disabled, and at that point we can come back and repair them. I teach them the repair as well. That's happened to me at, maybe a total of more than 20 countries by now, that I have brought someone through each of those stages and had each of them doing the repairs, the majority of them reducing them, the next of them reducing them with extraordinary techniques, and the third bringing out the loop of dead bowel that has already been incarcerated for too long and put it back together with them. So these are things that are possible to do. Now, fortunately, with my frequent visits, I'm able to take that group of people who have already been experienced and already had the experience of laying on hands in the primary care setting and bring them up to the point where they can manage. They would then be the go-to referral center for a number of others that they would train. And what I've done there is with patients who have come in who have been once incarcerated and once were reduced, I take those as the first ones to repair. And I say, we are now going to operate on this elective hernia repair as though it were the incarceration emergency that had first happened. And that way, we will not only solve this man's problem, so it will not recur, but we've also taught you what to do in the event that it doesn't reduce the next time. So we have graduated two folk there. One, the patient, making him a powerful patient and going back to his normal activity. Remember, we can't tell him, by the way, don't lift anything heavier than a book. Put your feet up and watch TV for the new 2 weeks. You know, I would say
he's
lucky to have a wall to plug it in, let alone the plug that goes in the wall. As a consequence, we're not talking about something that we would
tailor. If you can't lift much,
he's
not even going to have any warmth. You know, he can't go gather wood or food or whatever.
Exactly that. So that, in fact, that's not usually a problem. There are almost always around him. That's why I say the community is so important. No single individual comes to me. They come together with their surrounding caregivers. And those caregivers are the ones that have constantly got a little cooking fire, because we're talking about the tropics. And wood fires there for cooking things are absolutely essential, because if you cook something and then turn your back on it for 3 hours, the coliform count goes through the roof and it starts to spoil, as all vegetation does in the tropics, very quickly. So as a consequence, there's always some source of warmth or heat. If nothing else, putting a pan of water out in the sun, they all have these plastic basins that are mass-produced and are used until they don't hold anything at all, allows at least warm water. We use solar power in a very passive way out there. We try with ingenuity to make up with that which we don't have in high-tech stuff. And the high-tech stuff doesn't answer all of our questions. In fact, it's the judgment that goes into its use that's common to both settings.
Interesting. So there's a trust and a faith element in this too, right? When you're talking about, you know, who's the go-to person, they already have trust in certain individuals who have a good track record of being kind and soothing. What's the importance of that element? Because I'm sure when you go into a community, you have to gain that trust. You have to earn it.
Well, two of those immediately. First, communication is important, and they have the local language. I don't want to be speaking a colonist's language. That could
right.
be English in the former British Empire. It could be French in the Francophone nations. It can be Portuguese in the Lusophone ones. And I come there essentially trying to live their life with them in their language. That is, I know their common greetings, and I know where does it hurt. I have a socially embarrassing habit of asking women when their last menstrual period was, because that's usually the first thing I have to ask if they have abdominal pain. I suspect with you, Joyce, that we can skip that question altogether, but I would have it
in a couple of languages other than
English.
But I'm sure that in many cultures, it's probably not done for a man to ask that of a woman, just in general.
Well, even more interesting than that, I hear on Beacon Street out there in Boston, if you had that same
question asked
on the road, every one of those individuals would look at you and glower at you and say, you know, that's my business entirely and none of yours. In much of my African nations especially, but around the tropical belt of the globe, fertility is considered a social resource, and often when asking a woman when her last menstrual period was, the fourth person over will answer. And that is almost the same as saying, have there been adequate rains for a good crop this year, or something like that. It's almost a community resource. And now I, as a male, have fallen in exactly like E.T. from another environment, another extraterrestrial one.
Yes.
And therefore, they allow me certain little cultural aberrations like that. But once they recognize the value of health care, then they will accept from their own people as well a male not only asking such questions, but also touching and doing something in order that they might benefit the patient. And that's even true in my Islamic conditions. I was in Afghanistan, where I do not do normal deliveries. It would be unseemly for me to touch a woman until and unless she has an obstructed labor, at which she becomes prime patient material for me. So they too know that extremity requires help from any source they can get it. And I am a resource for them, just as I try to make sure that everyone there is known as a resource. That was number one, the communication skills and the cultural acclimatization there. Number two, when I'm there, I constantly point out that they are being cared for by their indigenous people there, and I'm doing whatever I can to help and enhance them. I don't want them to think that, well, only a white man knows how to do a C-section. After all, you guys, you walk on the moon, so therefore, you know, you can do this magic, but nobody here could ever know or ever learn, because after all, he's just like me. He lives two huts over. He doesn't have shoes either. So what on earth could he know that you can impart to him that would make him powerful? Well, in fact, I point that out to them all the time when I say, look at what AJAC has done. No, not AJAC. I mean, you did it. No. I say, you'll notice that next week when I'm no longer here and it keeps on being done, that it can't be me that's doing it. They give me far too much credit, but they say, oh, but you taught AJAC. And that may be true, but the AJACs of the world had to have their primary motivation to get going. There are a couple of folks, I call them, there's a parlance that comes out of the social sciences called the positive deviant. Let's say the whole world is falling in on you. Everything is going apart, and there are lots of disaster areas in a world like this. But what most people do is hunker down, pull in their head, and sit there and wait for the expected devastation to hit them. There are a couple who say, now wait, we can't handle all that, but this much we can, so let's get about doing it. Find that person. Do whatever you can to enhance whatever he can do. And not only that, see if he can teach and clone others to do that. So rather than having the society implode around you into dependence on some outsiders, now remember those outsiders may be far away, they may not be interested in you, they may have problems of their own, they may not have the economics that's allowing them to extend themselves out there by aircraft or other means that nobody there can afford. They may, in fact, be antithetical to that group. No, they're of a different religion, or they vote a different ticket, or there are competitors and following. So all of that means we have to indigenize skills, and we have to make these people not only empowered, but seen so by their people around them. So I never swagger in there. There's one thing that I find that only politicians and physicians have the arrogance to ever say to another human being, I know what's best for you.
Well,
wait a minute, you don't even know me. How can you say that? You don't speak my language. You don't know what a dinar is. You only use dollars.
Right.
And in fact, I don't have any kinship at all. As a matter of fact, I say that about my students. And when we get there, I point out to them, these people, different cuisine, different costumes, different clothes or lack of it, and don't have shoes, and don't speak the same language, and don't know the economics, and have never voted one man, one vote, democracy. I say, these people are not at all like us. They are us. And until and unless you understand that and appreciate it, you will say only the human dignity that you hope to have as the respect they give you is that which we are going to return to them and do whatever we can to enhance and empower them.
Right. Let me ask you this. I mean, just coming up a level, and obviously not with the distinctions that you see between modern U.S. hospitals and the depths of the Sudan, but just dealing with rare diseases in different parts of the world, I talk with people in 108 different countries about von Hippel-Lindau disease, and obviously first they have to get to a certain level of consciousness in medicine to even know that they have such a rare disease, but then they'll say to me,
even
well,
in the U.S.
No, I'm even in the U.S., that's true. But, you know, somebody will call me from another country and they'll say, oh, my son has a brain tumor. Where can I fly him in the U.S. or Germany or wherever? And we might do that for that one situation, but then I say to them, okay, but we have to build resources for you and your family around you where you live. Because you can't have aunts, uncles, cousins, and children with a rare disease and expect to get all your care in another country. It's not realistic. You really need to build resources around yourself, much in the same way that you're doing, but at a different level, obviously, because it does take doctors and hospitals and so forth to deal with a disease like VHL. But it's been a very big adventure for me, and we have a handbook in how to manage your health of rare VHL, which is now in 14 languages. And one of the things that I learned was until you're in the local language, you are not talking to the patient, and you are not talking to the patient's regular doctor. So as you say, that respect for the culture and for trying to work with people, and it's all well and good to say ultrasound's not good enough, you need an MRI, but in some parts of the world, ultrasound is what there is, and MRI is not there. So deal with it.
You are exactly right, Joyce, and you have a slice of humanity across the world in 108 nations and 14 languages, a piece of what I deal with in trying to take on a broader spectrum of the same thing. And I look at them and I say, you and I are exactly alike with one exception, and that happens to be a tiny spot on chromosome 3. And, you know, through the grace of God, I happen to have missed that, and you happen to collect it, so let's see what other resources you have in those other chromosomes to help out and to deal with this. So I would agree with one thing you said in that earlier description, that someone that calls you up and asks for a medevac to get somebody out with a brain tumor, bring them over here. Well, now, remember that I deal with a lot of unenlightened aid groups who come across saying, well, now, of course, we've got to help those people, so I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to deliver blank to them, or we're going to pick them up, carry them over here, and teach them cardiovascular surgery or something like that. Well, that makes them a misfit. Any go-to person over there who's quite bright and comes over here is now, should he be so lucky as to get into such a training system, although he wouldn't be accepted until he'd gone to school for 12 years beyond that which he had graduated from and then come through another residency and fellowship and so on, then he would be ideally adapted to a disease he has never seen in his native country. Number one. Number two, everybody in, let's say, Illinois or Iowa, especially politicians, are more than eager to feed the world or to dam the rivers to make hydroelectric and to stabilize the water supply and give recreational and fishing and so forth. Wait a minute. Who are those people that are desperate to help those folks out there in the other parts of the world? They are the representative who is interested in farm subsidy support. And therefore, we can dump lots of food in other parts of the world. What does that do to the local farmers but cut them off at the knees because they cannot compete with free? What do we find in the place that wants to dam the river and build a nice hydroelectric high-technology power plant? Well, he happens to be from the constituency of Caterpillar, and they want to use the Earth movie. So every big-ticket donor is a big donation to the donor and not the recipient. Let me give you one example of that. I was in Maputo, Mozambique, in the central teaching hospital called Universidad Eduardo Mondlane. It's the single teaching hospital in the whole of Mozambique. And it didn't have bed linen, it didn't have aspirin, it didn't have penicillin. It did have an MRI Siemens scanner. And why? Because that was a donation from the Federal Republic of Germany to Siemens, not to Mozambique. And as a consequence, we have to be very careful of what it is that we give to people, saying your only solution for your many, many problems is to become exactly like me and the one that I happen to know best. Well, that may not be appropriate. It may not be appropriate, for example, to say, come on over here to George Washington University Medical Center. We're going to teach you to be a cardiovascular surgeon when, in fact, they don't have coronary artery disease. In fact, that's one of the things that I put on my list when I carry my little notepad around with me. And you talked about the exotic diseases. Yeah, I teach people about malaria, and I talk about the worms, and I talk about trachoma, and I talk about filariasis, and all those things that they've never seen before. And I say, take your little notepad and write down whatever you see about those exotic diseases that these people have. But here, use the other end of that notebook, or a bigger one, and I want you to write down those things that you do not see that fill up four-fifths of our beds. Hiatus hernia and varicose veins and inflammatory bowel disease and biliary tract disease and atherosclerosis and all those things that they have not ever developed. So what is it that they are doing right that we can learn from them? So don't say that these poor and impoverished people are so stupid and ignorant and everything else like that they have these exotic disease. Ask them how it is that we got so stupid as to develop stuff that they have never experienced. And I ask that rather frequently of people around me, saying, those things that we have as degenerative disorders are not common among them. So why can't we learn from them that which they can teach us? And then we will give them whatever it is that we can do in an indigenized skill.
Things like nutrition and exercise, just for starters. Let me ask you one other thing because we're down to the last 5 minutes here. But I've been reading The Emperor of All Maladies, which is basically a biography of cancer. And he's talking about how especially the cigarette industry has exported tobacco all over the world and is therefore exporting cancer all over the world, and that we can expect 70% of the cancers in the next decade to arise in the third world. So what is your perspective on how we're going to deal with those kinds of diseases in areas where we don't have hospitals, we don't have oncologists, we don't have the drugs that cost $50,000 a year you can absolutely forget? So what are we going to do in those parts of the world?
You're talking to an endurance runner who's come around the Commonwealth of Beacon there fairly frequently on the Boston Marathon, so you could probably imagine my opinion on smoking. However, look at it in a different perspective. I'm from Washington, D.C., and assume a politician is here talking to you instead of a physician who might be a bit of a humanitarian. The politician has a win-win situation, which he cannot possibly lose. What he can do is subsidize tobacco. Our number one dollar export, not in terms of bushels of grain, our number one agricultural export is tobacco in dollar terms. As a consequence, grain has been so cheap and tobacco has been so expensive that what we have done is generated a huge amount of cash with taxable incomes to farmers who are happy, and we export all the death and destruction and the health care costs that come along with it. If we had it here inside, we know very much how much of the U.S. consumption of healthcare resources comes from the tobacco industry. Therefore, what we can do is get all the wins and let them have all the losses. They, of course, will not be able to manage those. And so despite the fact that we don't manage very well either with such things as lung cancer, nor with esophageal or with other heart diseases that come along with this as a consequence, that's an almost insatiable demand. They don't even start with that demand. They would simply die. You know that tobacco and its uses are much higher in other parts of the world than now in the somewhat slowly enlightening United States, but that economic incentive is still there. So how do these people deal with bigger problems? In fact, non-communicable disease is a growing thing in Africa. And what do you deal with these cancers? First of all, cancer is often a disease of extended life. Under 5 years of age, there aren't that many cancers except in your unusual instances of VHL and leukemia, lymphomas, and neural cancers. But the acquired cancers later in life are those that have been supported by someone who's had a lifetime income and insurances and all those other things. They don't have emergency rooms and cardiac care units and things like that, and never will have them. So as a consequence, the burden of an accumulated lifestyle-inflicted disease pattern would be unsupportable. And in fact, urban Africa is the largest growing population in that continent, and they are now developing obesity, diabetes, coronary disease, renal failure, and all those things that choke our hospital beds here. So what we have to do is to say, here's an ideal intervention where you can get in an epidemiology, prevent this disease before you have to treat it because it's untreatable. It is unsupportable in its treatment. Yes, there are some unfortunate things that happen to us genetically, like VHL, for which we should go to the wall with everything that we can in curative care. There are also things that are cumulative, acquired, and degenerative. And you've mentioned one of them, the tobacco, and the other is in the high-calorie atherosclerotic diets. And those, all of the marbles are being put on the front end. Here's an untouched planet. It's like C.S. Lewis once said, what if we shoot off one of those astronauts into outer space and they reach an unfallen planet? What would that do other than contaminate them with our habits? And so I say, here's an ideal situation to teach them what mistakes we have made that they need not repeat.
Right. That's really well said. Thank you very much. And so an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as they always said. So the best thing to do is to try to prevent some of these diseases that we have acquired in with our modern lifestyles here in the U.S., and hopefully we can learn those lessons and share the lessons with the world. Let me just remind everybody the title of your book. It's Dr. Glenn W. Gielhoed. It's spelled G-E-E-L-H-O-E-D. And the book is Gifts from the Poor, What the World's Patients Taught One Doctor About Healing. Thank you so much, Dr. Gielhoed, for being with us today. And we hope that everybody will be with us again next week. We'll have another program for you. And meanwhile, definitely be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you all for being with us. Bye-bye.